welcome to Dragons, Gazelles, and Unicorns, a podcast that brings to light breakthroughs in commercialization, economic impact, and world dynamics. Today, we have a very special guest, Maria Jones, the president and CEO of LIFS, the Local Initiatives Support Coalition, a national community development financial institution catalyzing opportunity for all. Previously, Maurice served as the Deputy Undersecretary of HUD in the Obama administration, and then as the Virginia Secretary of Commerce. We are really excited to have you, Maurice, today. You're going to provide some extremely valuable insights for our viewers, which are entrepreneurs and investors, and actually very much in alignment with what LIFS is working on. So can you please talk a little bit about your career and how you got to where you are?
Sure. Well, first, nice to be with you, and happy Monday morning, and happy day before election.
Yes.
in terms of how I got to where I am, it has not been a linear path. That's probably the best way of putting it. I graduated from law school and practiced law. I discovered pretty quickly that the practice of law was not what God had ordained for me. It's probably the best way of saying it. And I proceeded from there to try to find a line of work that allowed me to be interested in what I was working on, and most especially doing some good, fighting for the people that I wanted to fight for, basically. And so I actually did two tours of duty through the federal government. You mentioned one. I was a DepSec at HUD. I was also at the Treasury Department, U.S. Treasury Department, for 6 years in the Clinton administration. I also did two tours of duty through Virginia state government. I was head of what we call Commerce and Trade, Secretary of Commerce and Trade, and also was a deputy chief of staff and head of social services for Mark Warner. I then ran a newspaper business. I wanted to be in a business that both was a business that would help me learn and refine business acumen, but at the same time do good, to perform a public service. I worked at a philanthropy organization called Venture Philanthropy Partners. And then I have been at LISC now for about 4 years. I'd say the common denominator remains to be my search for a job that allows me to make a living and do good at the same time. And this job here at LISC is a great combination of the two. It allows me to work on development finance initiatives all over the country. I'm enjoying it immensely. There's a lot of work, as you know, to be done. But all of the previous jobs have really been preparation for this job. I can take something from each of my previous jobs. I have to work with the public sector, for example. So my experience in the public sector has been helpful in this job. I have to also work with the media. I have to understand communications and marketing and sales, and my role at the newspaper certainly helped me with that. I have worked in philanthropy, and now philanthropy is one of my biggest partners. I work with local government, I work with federal government. So, and my law, both my law degree and my legal experience certainly helps me with trying to master subjects that are new to me and to put them to good use. So I would love to tell you I designed it this way. I did not. But the journey has been fun, and I'm looking forward to the future.
That's really cool. You know, we created a company during the pandemic called Ignite Social Impact. I'm very much like you. I have always wanted to be able to make an impact on the world while using my skill sets, and my path has been extremely nonlinear as well. But for one common factor for sure between the both of us is this desire to make an impact on the world and do good while also, you know, making, you know, doing blazing new trails. But what has driven you to want to do good? Do you think that you?
You know, I was raised in a town of 1,200 people in rural Virginia on my grandfather's and grandmother's tobacco farm. They raised me. And so my grandfather, just to give you a data point, was born in 1914. My grandmother was born in 1918. My grandfather went to school for 6 years in a barn. And then he went out and went to work in the fields, as he would say, or in the woods, cutting pulp wood, working for sawmills. My grandmother lived close to town. And because she lived close to town, she could walk to the quote unquote colored school and ended up graduating from that and getting her high school diploma. These were and have been in my lifetime, the most brilliant, the most talented, the most loving folks with whom I've crossed paths. And their trajectory was limited by their race and by the country's discrimination against Black folks, African Americans. And so from day one, it was very clear to me that there was much work to be done in this country before we truly lived into the notion that we were equal under the law, that we all had a chance to be all we could be, that there was true justice built into our systems. And that formative experience growing up in my grandparents' home on a farm in a rural town, also that had challenges as well as lots of joy and lots of good, loving people. That experience from day one was an experience that consciously and unconsciously has motivated me to try to do everything I can to be helpful to folks like my grandparents, to places like my hometown, Cambridge, Virginia. And then built onto that, I know that I would not be sitting here talking to you today if it weren't for the love of grandparents and teachers and mentors and friends. And so I know everything I have, I don't deserve. I owe to the love of others, which means, as my grandparents used to always say to me, the real way that you pay that back is by doing it for others. And so there have been a number of different forces, if you will, influences that have led me to believe that, hey, it is my duty to try to do everything I can to be of service to others.
Wow. You know, I grew up in rural West Virginia. My father died when I was four. And he was pretty amazing. I did definitely torture him a lot. But we moved to West Virginia, and my mom had six kids. So my mom was working on having 12. And, you know, she got to nine, but
wow.
Died. But then when we moved to West Virginia, you know, we're the only Catholics in the town. So they thought we were all witches, which came to my advantage occasionally, you know, because if something or if anyone was mean to me, I had to say, I'm going to get my
brain. Yeah, there you go.
But I understand that the rural area, my mom started playing piano and organ for the churches. And then they decided she's not a witch anymore. And they made her the mayor. But
there you go.
I certainly do feel the same way you do in terms of being growing up in a very rural town and being very blessed to have people around you that can send you in the right direction.
I've had so many angels in my life. what I aspire to do is to be an angel for somebody else. Obviously, I got a lot of work to do on that front, but yeah, that's what, at the end of the day, that's what motivates me.
Awesome. Well, you mentioned, can you maybe describe a little bit more about LISC
and sure.
how does sure. it work? And
yeah, so LISC is a 40-year-old enterprise at this point, which is amazing. In fact, 41 years old. And it is, I think the best way of describing it, I tell people all the time, we're in the opportunity business. LISC attempts to catalyze opportunity for people, for places, for organizations. And what we do is we use tools to be helpful in that regard. We provide grants, we provide loans, we provide equity investments, we provide tax credits, we provide technical assistance, with the goal being to catalyze such assets as affordable housing and small businesses and needed community facilities like Boys and Girls Clubs and arts incubators and systems change in the public sector, all with the focus on fighting poverty and catalyzing opportunity. So in 40 years' time, for example, we have invested about $22 billion in grants and loans and equity. And we have, as a result, produced about 420,000 units of affordable housing, housing that's affordable to people and families who are earning anywhere from 80% of the area median income all the way down to on the verge of homelessness. And we've produced 70 million or so of space in that's community facilities. There, I'm talking about healthcare centers and commercial facilities for businesses and fields for folks to recreate on and play sport on, and grocery stores. So it's all about trying to use tools of money and time and treasure and talent to help people and places achieve economic mobility. That's really what we do. And we go in and we partner with organizations to do this work. And we have about 36 offices around the country. We work in another 2,200 rural counties. We have invested in every state in the union. I'd like to tell you that we've solved the opportunity problem in the country. We have not, which means we've got plenty more work to do and plenty of partners to work with. And it's I'm grateful for the chance to do this kind of work.
I can imagine it's very fulfilling. I'd be grateful as well.
It is.
I feel the same way, because obviously, you know, the Center for Advanced Innovation, we launch these startups. And yep. I can pinch myself every day. And I'm sure you can too.
Yeah. No, it's definitely right. You know, I think the amazing thing for me is to see, you know, if you watch the headline news at the end of the day, you would think the country was literally falling apart. And don't get me wrong, we have plenty of challenges. But every day I see miracles happening all around the country. And that gives me inspiration to get up the next day and to keep fighting. And so I hope that your listeners and your viewers will feel encouraged that miracles are happening in small towns and big cities in the north and the east and the west. What we need is more people working with these miracle doers and these miracle makers, so we can help more folks, period.
Can you give the listeners an example of one of your favorite stories of making miracles?
You know, I remember meeting this young man at one of my site visits, and he came up to me and I said, "How you doing?" He says, "I'm doing great." And he says, "I want to thank you for the work that you all are doing in the workforce development space. We have a strategy called Financial Opportunity Centers, which combines financial literacy coaching with case management around housing and transportation and childcare with intense workforce development." He says, "I was imprisoned," he said, "for about 7 years on a drug charge." And he said, "I got out, I couldn't find work. And I heard about your Financial Opportunity Center. And so I went," and he said, "and now here I am." He says, "I have American Welding Society certification." He goes, "I'm a manager. I manage other people who are also welders." He said, I'm making a living. And he said, "I got my life together." And he goes, "I got to really thank you for that." Young African-American male, early 30s at best. And I looked at him and I said, "Man, that's terrific." I said, "I'm so pleased for you. And I'm pleased that we could be a part of your journey. And I'm glad you got this great job. You're making a good living." And he looked at me. He goes, "No, man." He says, "It's much bigger than that." He said, "I have a daughter." And he said, "For the first time in my life, I can be her father."
Wow.
Yeah. And, you know, I have a daughter. And so that really moved me to see, to be schooled by this guy that, it's much bigger than this job, man. He's like, "My most important job is fatherhood." And he goes, "I'm doing it. And I'm doing it with your help." And for me, that's what it's all about.
Well, it's the third time I've gotten goosebumps from you, Maurice. Amazing. I've had the opportunity to have some of those conversations as well, and it's really moving. You don't sometimes even know what impact you've had. Yeah, it's amazing.
Yeah.
So where does all this money come from? With Lyst, where does it?
So it's a combination of sources. We have very, very generous philanthropic support, and that philanthropic support comes from large philanthropic enterprises like the Ford Foundation or Kresge Foundation. It comes from individuals. We also receive grants and loans from financial institutions. Often those financial institutions are motivated by obligations that they have under the Community Reinvestment Act to invest back into these communities. And we are one vehicle through which they do that. We also get support from the public sector, local government, state government, and the federal government. We're a AA- company rated by one of the rating agencies, S&P. And so we can issue general obligation bonds that an individual or an institution can invest in. And then lastly, we generate our own revenues through our work. We're a financial institution at the base. And so we lend, we charge interest, and we make money off of the money that we lend, plus we perform consulting services. So we have a combination of ways that we generate the revenues that we use to do our work. And Lyst is, I should have mentioned, a family of four companies. We've got a nonprofit parent. We've got a subsidiary that is a syndicate of the low-income housing tax credit, which is the largest federal incentive for affordable housing. We generate revenues from that. We've got a subsidiary that is the largest allocatee of the new markets tax credit, which is a tax credit which allows you to do mixed use projects, housing and commercial. We generate revenues from that. And then we have a small business lending company called Emito that makes loans to small businesses, and we can generate revenues there. So we've got a combination of ways that we generate revenues so that we're not dependent on any one source in order to fuel the work that we try to do.
So if a small company came to you and wanted to gain access to some of your funding, what criteria would you have to assess whether or not they're a good fit for you? Or is
First is mission, right? We our work is focused on being helpful to low-wealth individuals, low-wealth communities, for example, people of color, people in rural areas. So there has to be a social and economic mission to this. If you just want to build, for example, high-end luxury housing, we're not, you know, that's not what we do. We want to fight poverty. We want to catalyze opportunity. We want to serve the underserved, right? We're like the, you know, a fireman sees a fire, they run to the fire. Well, we see poverty, we run to poverty. We see, you know, underserved community, we run to under. So first is mission, right? Do you align with us on mission? And then secondly, we have a due diligence process, right? If we're going to make a loan to you, then we definitely attempt to ascertain the realistic projection that you can pay the loan back. We do you no service, we do us no service, we do the community, the people no service if we make a loan to an individual, an organization that doesn't have a plausible pathway to paying us back. So we have a due diligence process that we utilize there as well. We also don't like to go it alone, if you will. What we like to do is to be part of a partnership of groups and individuals who are trying to get something done and who are trying to get something done over a period of time. So we also look at partnerships, and we look at the ability to have more than a transaction. We're looking for an agenda of improvement. And so all of those things are factored into our determination of whether this is the right fit for us or not.
So on the partnership side of things, what are there specific types of partnerships you look for?
Wow, we have multiple partnerships actually. And so again, the partnerships, we put together partnerships on the basis of what we need to get a job done. So, you know, in the housing space, for example, we have partnerships that include local CDCs and hospitals and philanthropies and local government and developers. I tell people, it's like making a layer cake, right? We just have multiple layers that we need to have in order for that cake to taste good. And the layers are not always composed the same way. It just depends on the project. But typically we'll have a local nonprofit, we'll have local government, we'll have local philanthropy, we may have a bank involved, we have residents of the communities that we're trying to work in. Those are some of our key partners in getting work done.
What is a CEC? For the audience?
Community Development Corporation. Sorry, I shouldn't use acronyms. They are enterprises that have been around since the civil rights movement, and they're usually organizations that are doing community development work in certain neighborhoods, right? And they usually are representative of the residents in that neighborhood, and they are trying to, you know, get housing preserved or get housing produced or protecting people's housing that may be at risk of losing it because of gentrification or displacement. They are working on workforce development in some places. It's a broad array of potential services, but at the heart of them, they are community-based organizations who are trying to, through multiple means, to help a community and a people of a community achieve progress.
So you've worked all across the United States. You've been doing development work in every single area. Are there areas in the U.S. that you would like to do more work in?
Every area. Okay. I'd like to do more work in rural America, particularly because I'm a country boy at heart, right? I was a farmer for the first 25 years of my life. I'm particularly keen on trying to give back to places that nurtured me. In this climate that we're living in now, I'm particularly aware of the racial wealth and health and opportunity gaps. And so we want to particularly focus on communities of color and trying to help communities of color close these health and wealth and opportunity gaps. And that's all across the country. And so we are particularly focused on those communities. We are also quite desirous of doing more with respect to Indian country and working with Native Americans, both on reservation and off reservation. These are the kinds of places. For LISC also in particular, we think we are underrepresented where poverty continues to grow at its fastest pace, and that's the Southeast and the Southwest. So if you look at our expansion plans, we're expanding in the South. And so the South is another place that we want to do much more work in than we're doing now. But the big picture in our country is, there are 40 million people living in poverty. Those are the places where we want to do more work. We want to eliminate poverty in America. And so as you might imagine, we got more work to do.
Well, it's interesting, Maurice, you mentioned the Southeast. We did a study 3 years ago on the areas of the United States that could dramatically improve from the point of view of economic prosperity and that are underperforming. And we found that the Southeast is the number one area. And the name of the podcast is, I'll share with you the report that we did. I think you'd appreciate, we did a really deep dive into the different areas, like literally county by county in the states in the Southeast. And this podcast is called Dragons, Gazelles, and Unicorns. What we found was that the Southeast also had the highest concentration of gazelles. So gazelles, we analyzed, I think we couldn't find any studies on gazelles. I mean, gazelles are companies that can grow by 3x, they're really fast growing companies, but they're smaller companies. They're like IT type companies, and so on. But the Southeast also represented the highest concentration of gazelles that are gazelle type companies, but they're not growing as fast as they could grow, which could create a lot of jobs, because they're just underperforming gazelles. And if they're growing at the rate that most gazelles grow at, they would actually be, there'd be a lot more jobs for people.
It's interesting you say that. When people ask me about some of the key lessons that I take from this work, one is what you're alluding to, which is what we see is there is incredible talent and entrepreneurs everywhere.
Yes.
I mean, everywhere we work, urban, rural, north, south, east, west, what's not equitably distributed is opportunity.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
And so that's where we want to marry opportunity with talent, right? We want to catalyze opportunity for that talent, because we know that that talent will take that opportunity and run with it. But the opportunity is what's imbalanced in our country, which is not equally distributed, and we've got more work to do. And it's a combination of, frankly, eliminating barriers and creating opportunities. It's both that we have to do.
You know, Maurice, I think about what you're talking about with regards to opportunity. And, you know, the model that we have at the Center for Advanced Innovation is we run these big challenges, and part of the challenge is an accelerator. And anyone can come into our challenge. I mean, we do have a bar, but if someone wants to come into our challenge, we help them get in. And so 46% of the people that come into our challenge are from underserved regions in the United States. And so because basically what we want to provide this platform for people to get a mini MBA, regardless of the level of education that they have. It's really exciting to see people grow. They grow so much in our programs. It's like, so I don't have any children, but it's amazing to see a transformation in people in 8 months.
And yeah, I hear you.
Given the opportunity, you know?
Yeah.
I was just thinking back to, you know, how you grew up for 25 years in the farm. And you know, growing up in West Virginia, also a very, very rural area. It's called Cape and Bridge. It's about an hour and a half from where I'm in Bethesda right now.
I was going to ask you, so what is it? It's northeast West Virginia?
So you know how West Virginia has the panhandle on the right-hand
side? Yeah.
In the neck there is, there's Winchester right above it.
Yep.
And then there's right there in the neck is Cape and Bridge, it's called.
I got you.
Yeah.
I got you.
Yeah. It's a tiny little town. You know, a lot of people, you know, I think about, you know, how you grew up and how I grew up a lot of people didn't get out, you know, when I say didn't get out, you know, you have to create your own opportunity occasionally.
Yeah.
My mom just had a rule, and, you know, we never would break any of my mom's rules. And the rule was you get an Ivy League education and full scholarship. I'll drop you off. If you graduate magna cum laude, I'll pick you up. So that was the rule. And you know, don't expect anything from me.
I hear you. Yeah. You know, my grandparents wanted me to be nice. They wanted me to work hard. They wanted me to get all the education that I could get. You know, those were their sort of basic, uncompromising values that they wanted to make sure I adhered to. And, you know, I owe them everything I have.
Awesome. Those are great pillars. So you were very fortunate to have those grandparents.
Mm, no question. Yeah. Game changers.
I feel the same thing about my mom. Yeah, talk to her a lot. She's still my best friend.
That's good stuff.
Yeah.
That's good stuff.
So you, Liz, you just came and put out an agenda on October 28th, just a few days ago.
Oh yeah.
There's a lot of things here: affordable housing, capacity building, economic development, education, financial stability, health policy, racial equity, rural, safety and justice. Can you maybe highlight a couple of the elements of the agenda that you'd want to emphasize beyond what you've already discussed?
Yeah, sure. You know, one piece of the agenda deals with housing, for example. If you look at what's happening in our country, to try to simplify it and fully acknowledging that the simplification is not going to be completely accurate, but to simplify it, the country has produced an overabundance of luxury multifamily units and an inadequate supply of housing units affordable to middle income earning families and below. And so our system needs help in producing and protecting and preserving housing for that missing middle in below, right? And so if you look at our housing proposals, a lot of what they focus on is the kinds of federal support that is needed in order to protect and produce and to preserve more housing units that are affordable across the economic spectrum, as opposed to this oversupply, if you will, at the top of the economic spectrum. We don't have a problem at the top of the economic spectrum with housing, plenty of housing there. It's, you know, where are your teachers and your firefighters and your first responders and your medical technicians and your frontline folks who've been frontline with respect to COVID? Where are they going to be able to live in all of our great urban and rural areas moving forward? Our housing proposals are about what we need from the federal government in order to close this gap in housing supply for people who are not at the high end or not pursuing high-end luxury places. So that's one. You'll see we also have workforce development proposals. And if you look at what's happening in the country, this is pre-COVID and even after COVID, what you have is a situation where if you look at the job skills that are going to be needed moving forward, we still will need, you know, people with four-year degrees and engineers, et cetera, but we need just as many folks who have post-secondary certifications and licenses and who can perform what are called these middle skills jobs. If we don't have people with welding certifications, with medical technician certifications, who can code, who can work in construction and megatronics, then we can't grow this economy because half of the jobs are jobs in those spaces. And so what our workforce pieces are focused on is how we can make sure that more people from different communities across the country have the opportunity to get on a viable pathway to a post-secondary license and or certification, right? And then the last piece is the small business piece that I'll comment on. We need more women of color, more men of color, more women, more folks in rural areas with a viable pathway to launching and owning businesses. And what we try to do with some of these small business proposals is entice or invite the federal government to be a better partner in that kind of entrepreneurship stimulation, if you will, or incentives. Those are the kinds of things that you see us trying to do with the proposals that we have put forward there. There's lots of other things, but those are sort of basics of what we're aspiring to.
On the small business front, how are you going to be going about implementing that?
So what we'd like to do, what we'd like to do is to have more tools to invest the right kind of capital at the right time for these businesses, mm-hmm. whether it's startup capital or look, if you're a lot of businesses, when they get started, they rely on a family and friends network, right? Well, guess what? If you're an African-American or another person of color trying to launch a business, your family and friends network, more likely than not, not always, but more likely than not, is not a place that you can go to, right? And so we want the federal government and state governments and philanthropy and others to come together and create more pools for to serve as the proxy for family and friends network for these kinds of individuals who are trying to launch. And so we can implement that, right? We just need a partnership to work with us to do it. Now, let me go further. The other thing that we need is a vibrant ecosystem in communities with which to work, which is the other thing that you see us trying to do, is to try to provide, or try to incent and bring the federal government and others into this business of providing capacity building assistance. Some cases it's money, it's in some cases it's mentorship, it's help with achieving space, it's tax credits, et cetera, to build a strong ecosystem around these businesses to help them with the many needs that they have, both urban and rural. And so you implement these things, to your question, you implement them locally, right? You think nationally, but you got to implement them locally. Proximity matters when it comes to small business. You can certainly use some technology, but helping small businesses launch and successfully grow is a contact sport. The closer you can get to these businesses, the better the ecosystem right around them, the better chances they'll have to thrive. And so that's what we're trying to incent, is partners who can build stronger proximate ecosystems for small businesses.
When you say vibrant ecosystems, what would you, if you could characterize what you think is a vibrant ecosystem?
Sure. Sure. So if you are a, let's say you are trying to build a graphic design business in the Twin Cities. Well, what would be ideal is if you had near you the ability, yes, to access capital, right? The capital that you need at the time that you need it. So whether that be local banks or local CDFIs, small business incentives from local government, philanthropic support, et cetera. So you need that capital, but you also need perhaps an incubator that you can go to and receive mentorship from other small business owners, or receive the ability to have access to people who have launched businesses, perhaps in your space or not in your space, accountants, lawyers who are willing to be helpful to you in setting up or incorporating businesses, all the kinds of things that you need in the way of support services that, by the way, larger businesses pay for all the time. Mm-hmm. So just as a large business needs a McKinsey and Company to help it with strategy, to help it with marketing, to help it with product innovation, small businesses need the same thing. Mm-hmm. And so that's the kind of ecosystem that I am speaking of, that we need to make sure we're building that ecosystem just as much as we're trying to invest directly into those businesses. So that's our, we tend to take a twofold approach. We want to invest directly in the businesses, and we want to invest in an ecosystem surrounding the businesses.
Mm-hmm. I got you. we only have 7 minutes left. I have so many questions to dive into. But I think I'm gonna switch gears a bit. And this is a historic day before a very hotly contested presidential election. Do you think the outcome of the election would impact the list trajectory?
Well, there's no question that the impact of the election will have an influence on us vis-a-vis particularly our partnership with the federal government. Mm-hmm. We are eagerly awaiting the results. We will continue to, our agenda will remain pretty steadfast and we will remain faithful to it. We need, though, a robust federal government partner to be the best we can be. Mm-hmm. And so we are eagerly anticipating the results of the federal election in particular. It will certainly influence the strategy that we use vis-a-vis the federal government to partner with it. You know, federal government right now invests about $40 million with us every year, for which we are grateful. And we would like, stronger partnerships with more federal agencies than we currently have partnerships with to do some of the work we're trying to do on behalf of the people in the communities that we're trying to serve. So, yeah, I'll be up watching the returns tonight for sure.
Yeah.
The federal government isn't our only partner, but it is a crucial and a very important partner. And we have been grateful for the work that we've been able to do. And the work is not done.
No, it's not. So if you could leave anyone with some words of advice from, you've already provided some extremely valuable input. There's a lot of investors that are on this podcast and entrepreneurs, budding entrepreneurs that listen to the podcast. What kind of advice would you give people who are building their businesses? What's like a lesson that you had in your lifetime that you would like to convey?
You know, I think, best lesson that I had that I think is apropos to a person building a business is one that my grandfather taught me over and over and over and over again, and that is get up when you're knocked down, right? That the only person who is defeated is the one that's no longer fighting. And in business, right, there are going to be peaks, there are going to be valleys. And what counts the most is that you are building resilience, that you're building your muscle to bounce back from setbacks. And that's in the way that you try to structure your business and also in life. And so what we like to do is to try to help more businesses and communities to become more resilient. And we want to be partners with all these businesses who are trying to build that kind of resilience. So that would be my parting words or humble words of advice is that always think about, okay, how do I ensure that if this doesn't go in the way that I planned it, I will be able to live and fight another day, right? It's all about bouncing back.
Yeah.
And so that's what it's all about. That's what it's all about in business. That's what it's all about in life.
Yeah. So Maurice, I don't think I've ever told you this story. I can tell you for 30 seconds. Goldman Sachs was my first job.
And I only, oh, no kidding.
I only wanted to work for Goldman or McKinsey. And I didn't have an MBA, but I had graduated, you know, high honors and 90s cum laude and whatever. And I had like lots of degrees and such. But the thing is, they required MBAs at the time. So I thought, well, you know, I don't really want to have to get an MBA right now because I already did my, you know, 3 degrees and 2 minors and whatever. And so I wrote to Goldman. I was told 145 times no by Goldman. And the 146th time, I wrote a proposal. And it finally got past the people who were the recruiters. And it got up to people who were on the capital markets, Mrs. Sockblock desk. And they hired me without an MBA. So I was the first analyst ever hired at that Lisa Sock Block desk. But they did say 145 times no. So I understand perseverance.
They made a mistake 145 times. So yes. The moral of your story is they were right one out of 146 times, right?
Oh my God, that's awesome. Thank you. Well, I'm so grateful for your time today. It's been incredibly valuable insights you provided. And I just want to repeat a few of the things that you mentioned today. So LISC marries opportunity with talent. They're miracle makers. We all have our personal angels. LISC is also about eliminating barriers. I love what your grandfather and grandmother said about the 3 things you should do. Be nice, work hard, and get a great education. And like firefighters go into fires, you know, you go into poverty. LISC goes into poverty. You said creating vibrant ecosystems of a contact sport and get up when you're knocked down. So I think those messages are, you know, the most valuable messages we could start our day with on this wonderful Monday. So Maurice, I'm very, very grateful for your time today.
Same here. Always a pleasure to talk to you. All the best to you. Talk to you again soon.
Okay, talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
All right, take care.